guys, welcome to the Everyday Warrior podcast. We've got Trey Yingst, who is a second time guest on the show. Trey, I can't recall when we last had your podcast. It had to be about 6 months ago. But it was early on when the war kicked off between Israel and Hamas. The first question I've got to ask you is, where are you coming in from on this one?
So today I'm from Tel Aviv, Israel's second largest city. Last time we were in the south, I was wearing a flak jacket near the Gaza border. So it's nice to be back in a city population.
You know, never tell somebody they looked. You just wake up for this?
Yeah. No. It's been a long week.
I can only imagine. How are you doing both physically and mentally? I've got to assume you're doing like 18, 20 hour days.
Yeah, it slowed down a little bit. We've got some help now, and it's tough. I mean, just the entire process has been difficult from the beginning, being in southern Israel on the morning of October 7th, and then the war that followed. I've been into Gaza five separate times with the Israeli military on embeds, oftentimes in firefights, one time in the middle of the night. And then you just have these stories that we've been following from the beginning that are emotionally draining. And as someone who not only does this for a job, but does this for a passion, I have trouble disconnecting from the story. And so if I'm here on the ground, I'm talking to people, I'm getting the latest information, and just the reality of war in general, but specifically this war, is that most of the updates are negative. And so it's a lot to consume, but you know, I'm focused on the mission. We're still continuing our coverage around the clock, and we've got this new book.
Is it safe to say it's an emotional roller coaster with what you're exposed to?
Definitely, because, and you can relate to this, but the early days of the conflict, right? Your adrenaline is pumping so much. You're going around the clock. You're seeing all this death and destruction, these bodies in front of you. Really, you're there for the worst day of someone's life again and again and again, but you don't process it. I don't process it in real time. It's only when things start to slow down a little bit, you can take a second to exhale. That's when you start to think about, oh, we were really close to death on that day, or whoa, I can't believe we saw that with our own eyes. And that's been tough, not just for me, but for the entire team.
Yeah. And we lose sight of the fact that you've got an amazing team of, you know, videographers with you, following you, who are exposing themselves to the same dangers. You bring up something that's funny is, you know, slowing down is almost the worst thing that can happen at times. It's, you know, when you're moving, you don't have time to reflect like when you stop. And you know, sometimes it's just safer just to not stop and just keep going and say, hey, I'll deal with this 2 months down the road. I'll compartmentalize until then. Do you feel like you have to compartmentalize quite a bit?
It's so refreshing talking to someone who gets it, because that's exactly what you do. You keep moving because that momentum allows you to complete the task at hand. But you have to compartmentalize, I think, because if you don't, it'll drive you crazy. I think the challenging part for me, and I'm finding this as I feel like I'm trying to reintegrate into society, is that you almost have to train yourself to be a normal person again and to talk to people who have not been covering war for the past year. And that can be really challenging, because you realize that you've just compartmentalized your professional and personal life, but now you need to sort of dip into that other folder. And it's not always a smooth transition.
No, it's not. And I want to get to that at the end of the podcast. I want to get into your book. So you have Black Saturday coming out on October 1st, which is a impartial, just holistic look at the scope of this conflict to give people a perspective of what's going on both sides. And, you know, you rarely get that from media these days. And the one thing I took for the viewers when I had you on the first time is your character shines through. Also, your drive shines through. And I want the viewers to realize, again, Trey, it's not an underestimation, is probably working 18 hours a day and found the time over the last few months to write on the side, I'm assuming, to get this book done, which is just, having written a book, it took 16 months back in the United States, really doing nothing, to crank that thing out, and you've done it in less time. And that's absolutely amazing. What sort of led you to, when did you start the process? When did you realize you needed to do a book to educate Americans on this and the world?
I knew days after the initial Hamas attack, we had a really unique perspective being in the middle of this attack as it unfolded. We got to southern Israel on the morning of October 7th, and there were literally people dying in front of us. I was talking to my cameraman today for a larger piece that we're doing about the 7th, and he said, "Look, man, there were firefights 200 meters from where we were. That gunfire wasn't just coming from the Israeli military, it was coming from Hamas." And it was a reminder of how close we were on that morning. And so I knew right then that we had a unique personal story. And as I started to speak to the people involved, I realized, okay, I can put this together into a broader story. And I knew very early on I'd call it Black Saturday because everyone on social media on X was calling this day Black Saturday. It aligned with the emotions that you felt. It was truly the darkest day in Israel's history. And it was one of the darkest days of my life personally to see all that up close. But when I started to gather those other stories, I realized, wait, I can weave all this together into a compelling narrative that people will not only learn more about what happened on the morning of October 7th, but in the weeks that we were now in the middle of as I started to write this from multiple perspectives. And I really appreciated you noticing during our last conversation, it's critical for all journalists, but for me, because it's just who I am as a journalist, to talk to everyone involved. And that's why Black Saturday is truly a book like no other, because I talk not only with Israeli civilians, soldiers, police officers, hostages who were dragged into Gaza and then released as part of the November ceasefire deal. I also speak with Palestinian civilians, Palestinian doctors, Palestinian journalists to understand what that morning was like inside Gaza and what the weeks were like that followed.
If I'm not incorrect, you've also talked to or spoken to Hamas leaders as well.
Yep. I spoke to Hamas leaders throughout this, and that perspective, I think, is really important to hear from in the book, right? Because as a journalist on the ground in the Middle East, as a war correspondent, everyone wants you to take a side. I have no side. The only side that I take is the side of truth. And that's why when you read this book or you look at our reports, I'm not here to make anyone believe anything. I'm not here to tell you what the right answer is. I'm here to present the facts and information, talk to everyone involved, and allow the viewer or reader to decide. And so in Black Saturday, you not only hear from senior Hamas officials, but you also hear for the first time in an exclusive sit-down interview with Israel's defense minister, Yoav Gallant. And you can look on the internet now, you won't find another print or video interview with him. And it's because he hasn't talked to anyone. He's done a few briefings off camera, but he's not sat down with anyone for an interview. And the reason that I have this access from senior Hamas leadership to senior Israeli leadership, it's all based on one thing. It's based on trust, because I don't tell these guys I'm going to make them look good. I tell them that I'm going to tell the truth. And they believe that they can share the information that they have with me and that I'll present it in an accurate and fair way.
Truth and trust are interesting concepts. I had an opportunity to sit down with former Secretary of State Schultz, and he said a line that stuck with me. He said, "Trust is the coin of the realm, not monetary, not anything else. It's trust." And you've been recognized as one of, and I'll say the best sort of wartime reporter. I mean, you're also Forbes 30 under 30. You're only 31 years old. You've accomplished so much. With media today, it seems like it's so polarized, it's one direction or the other. I mean, were you specifically with this book, did you see it as an opportunity to just be impartial and give the facts?
Yeah, absolutely. Because this conflict in particular, probably more so than any other conflict that I've covered, and I've reported on the ground all across the world, from Afghanistan to Pakistan to Iraq to Lebanon, the whole Gulf,
Ukraine.
Ukraine, right? I start to lose the list, right? And I spent almost 200 days in Ukraine on the front lines, often in the east and in the south. I interviewed Zelensky on the 1 year anniversary of the war. This conflict, though, right now that's unfolding before our eyes in the Middle East, I think is the most divisive. Everyone wants to have a side. They lose empathy. They lack empathy for others. And so I found that writing this book was a cathartic experience for me as someone who lived through the story and went into these communities, saw the aftermath of the massacre, the bodies everywhere, the death and destruction, and then saw horrific scenes also inside Gaza. It was not just that. I think it was an opportunity to present the facts, to present the human experience for Israelis and Palestinians. And my hope is that when people finish the book, they may not like that I talked to Hamas officials, or they may not like that I spoke with Israeli soldiers, depending on where they come from. But my hope is that they will finish the book and that they will say, I learned something. And you know what? There is some motivation behind the actions that are being taken by the other side. I may not agree with them, I may not support them, but I'm starting to understand that as a human, they're taking action for a reason.
So I've got to ask you, one, it's become a divisive topic, not only within the United States, but across the world. And you are right, people are taking one side or the other. And I probably fall into that camp. And at one point I was on Fox, I said, I'm empathetic, not sympathetic to the Palestinian people. So I've got to ask a question. You've talked to a lot of Palestinians in Gaza. Do they feel regret for what Hamas did? Almost like, they had no vote in the decision. It's just like, goddamn Hamas. Why did they do this? And now we're suffering the consequences.
It's a great question. And the way that I explain it as a journalist who reported in Gaza, not just since October 7th, but the first time I went to Gaza was 10 years ago during the 51-day war, Sukhothana. I was 20 years old. The war was raging, and I went in with a backpack and a DSLR because I wanted to be a war correspondent. I've been in Gaza many times since, oftentimes during rounds of conflict, but also sometimes just for breakfast. And so I've met everyone from the Nukba al-Qassam Brigade militants who came into Israel on the morning of October 7th. I've met Hamas politicians from the political bureau. I have met Palestinian civilians. I've met business owners and everyone in between. And the way that I can describe the viewpoint of Palestinians in Gaza is that everyone, as they do in Israel and around the world, they exist on a spectrum. And the viewpoints of this conflict and about Israel exist on a spectrum. Now, the percentages are different than Israel. And they're different than the United States on that spectrum in terms of extreme views or moderate views or pro-Israel, anti-Israel, but they definitely exist on a spectrum. And I try to capture that as best I can in a book that's nearly 300 pages by talking to a variety of people on the spectrum. One Hamas official that I interview, his views on Israel and the attack was that it was justified. And he tries to make almost excuses for the slaughter of civilians and tried to tell me actually in the process of our reporting that no civilians were targeted. And I told him, that's just a flat out lie. And if you want to lie to me, that's okay. You can say whatever you want to me, but I'm not only going to call you out of my book, I'm going to call you out on air. And I'm going to make sure that people know the truth because I'm not here to be spun. I think there are so many officials around the world that think they can spin journalists. I'm not here to be spun. I'm here to get the facts on the ground. And the facts are that a massacre was committed against a civilian population and people were slaughtered in their homes. But to get back to the question here, when you ask him about the situation and what happened on October 7th, he almost justifies the slaughter of civilians and the attack against Israel. There are some Palestinians that I interviewed, though, for the book that had a different view. And I think some people will be surprised by their view. There's one man, his name is Dr. Raed Mosa, and he's an eye doctor. And he worked for UNRWA, actually, an organization that's quite controversial given the fact that some of its members were in Israel on the morning of October 7th. But he was sad about October 7th. And I asked him, what did you do on that day? And he said, I reached out to my friends in Israel and I asked them if they were okay. And I said, well, how do you have friends in Israel? And he had studied in Tel Aviv. He went to medical school for 4 years in Tel Aviv. And I don't think he's necessarily a representative example of the average Palestinian viewpoint in Gaza, but the senior official isn't necessarily either. And so I think that the majority of Gazans that I have met are very poor. They are trying to get by. They're trying to keep their families alive. They don't necessarily like Israel, but they wish that the situation didn't happen from a standpoint of their homes are now destroyed and disease is spreading and they're struggling. There are also Palestinians who wish their only mission in life would be to kill Israelis, to kill Jews. And that's a really hard thing to explain to the reader, and it's hard thing to explain to the viewer. But I also think that that nuance is part of my job as a war correspondent, to capture those different stories. And then also when I can give numbers, right? Because there is a reality on the ground about numbers. The majority of Palestinians support Hamas. And that is something that's averaged from the West Bank and from Gaza. The current number right now from the latest that I've seen is about 40% in Gaza. The number has slightly gone down given the fact that some people are realizing this attack harmed Gaza for decades. There are thousands of people that are dead now. The infrastructure of Gaza is totally destroyed and there's no end in sight. And so the bottom line is we have to remember the Palestinian people elected us to run Gaza. The support of the October 7th massacre exists on a spectrum. Even the people who committed the massacre, and that's another thing that, and I'm very passionate about this topic, but not interesting that into Israel on October 7th. Some of them went into homes and slaughtered civilians. Others went straight to military bases and engaged soldiers. And others came around to loot. Some came around to take pictures on their phones and look around. It's part of my job as a journalist to give you all that information, and then you can decide, as the viewer or the reader, what you think about it.
Give us a sense of Israel, because it also we've seen that Israel is becoming divided on this topic. There's those that just want the war to end. There's those that want the war will not end until the destruction of Hamas. What is sort of the sentiment amongst the Israeli people based off the percentages you just gave towards Gaza of support for Hamas and things along those lines?
Also, a great question, right? Because there's a different, but also a breakdown on a spectrum, right? Because you've seen the 500,000 people last weekend that were demonstrating in the streets of Tel Aviv, Israel's second largest city, and they're calling for a ceasefire. They're calling for a hostage deal to end the war. Their focus and their main goal is to get the hostages out alive. They don't care how it happens. That's their focus. And when you ask them for a secondary position, you know, well, what do you think about the conflict as a whole? Where should things go? Why are you here? Why are you in the streets? And they say, well, the second reason I'm in the streets, and I heard this from many people, is to support the families of the hostages that are still inside Gaza. And so this has been an interesting thing too, right? Because I've interviewed so many of the family members of people who were taken hostage. I've interviewed hostages who were released as part of the November ceasefire deal. And even their views exist on a spectrum. One woman that I interviewed, I said, how do you feel about Palestinians after this? How do you feel about the people of Gaza after what happened? And she said, they shouldn't be blamed for the actions of Hamas. And I said, I mean, you were taken hostage. This is your viewpoint. She said, look, what happened to me was horrible, but I don't think that we should turn around and make it our aim to hate. We shouldn't meet hate with hate. And when you hear that as a journalist, you're like, whoa. I mean, like, how can someone who's endured truly hell on earth come out with some level of positivity? But this one particular woman, she said, I'm going to make it my life's mission to have people understand what happened to us, but not to hate. And I thought that was really powerful. Again, when we talk about the current spectrum in Israel, the main disagreement right now has to do with if the war should continue and what that should look like. So the people in the Likud party, let's say 30 to 40% of the population, those who support Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, they believe that the war should continue until Hamas is completely destroyed. And that could mean risking the lives of hostages. Now, Israel's defense minister, Yoav Gallant, and just 48 hours ago, I was in his office in the Kiryah, Israel's version of the Pentagon, asking him these very questions. And I've met with him a number of times throughout the war, but most recently, just 48 hours ago, when we're having this conversation, he wants a deal. He thinks that Israeli forces can temporarily pull out of some of the sensitive sites in Gaza, including the Philadelphia corridor that sits along the Egypt-Gaza border. And then if they have to go back in afterwards, they will. But he wants a deal now to get the hostages who are still alive out, and then they can continue the war after. So I would say that's the current disagreement among Israeli society. When you ask the Israeli people what they think should be done with Gaza, this actually I think is probably one of the most interesting realizations from Black Saturday, my new book, but also will be from our conversation. And I think that people don't understand what an attack like October 7th can do to the psyche of a population. And I know this because I've lived here for the past 6 years. And I know I have friends who are in the army, who are in reserves in Milouim. And people who I previously would have put in the folder of moderate, even some of the people I would have put in the folder of left for Israel, who are closer to peace activists, a solution that emboldens Palestinians and gives them more rights and statehood, people who were in that camp after the massacre that took place, after they saw what happened. And they saw when hostages were taken back into Gaza and there were civilians in the streets of Gaza cheering, that those images and that attack changed their psyche in a way that I couldn't, had you asked me on October 6th about this concept, I would not have been able to vocalize it. But I saw it in a way, and I asked a few friends about it that I'm close with because you know this. So like when there's guys who you've been around with and you feel more comfortable with, you can ask them in a more personal way, like, why did your views change on this? And one of my friends said to me, he said, if it's going to be us or them, it's going to be them. What, and you, as a journalist, you hear that and you start to understand.
You don't have to experience that on scene for that to formulate your perspective. I mean, again, I said this on the news. When this broke out, I said, I have a long-term memory. And one of my memories from TV, news, media, was the Palestinians celebrating in the streets on 9/11. And that formulated my view. If I put it, I put them in this camp, it's us versus them, period. And they give the tacit support to Hamas. You know, you've lived through not only the Israel-Hamas conflict, but also the...
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.
Conflict with Iran and the attacks. To what degree, I mean, in the book, do you go into the, let's call it the Iranian sort of debacle in how they are the impetus or the cause of a lot of the funding to Hamas, to Hezbollah? Do you go heavy into Iran at all in the book?
Yeah, I do. I talk about Iran quite significantly in the context of the support and funding for Hamas and Islamic Jihad, and also Hezbollah, who's been directly involved in this fight. Literally, as we are speaking, I have had to put on Do Not Disturb on my phone and my computer because I was getting alerts of rockets coming into the north. Gives you a sense of how active this story is. And I've reported on that story extensively as well from both sides of the border. We've reported in Beirut. I've also reported in the north of Israel. I mean, I think that when you step back and you look at Iran's role in all of this, you have to look at the things that they're saying and take them at face value, right? It's not actually so hard. And I think a lot of people want to believe that Iran is playing 4D chess, and they're not. They're saying they want to destroy Israel, and they're currently trying to develop a nuclear weapon that they could use to do so. And they are openly funding and supporting their proxies across the region. And so I was here when Iran launched that ballistic and cruise missile attack. I was watching Israel's aero defense system intercept these incoming missiles overhead. I wasn't in a shelter. I was watching from a balcony because that's what we do as war correspondents. But when that happened, it changed the calculation for Israel because Israel understood that Iran is no longer afraid to attack from their own soil. But it was also a reminder to the world, and I talked about this on Fox quite a bit during that time, that Iran doesn't just have to attack from their soil to put pressure on Israel. Hamas and Islamic Jihad officials have told me that they receive funding and support from the Iranian regime. We have that on camera from 2019, 2018. This isn't new. If you look back at some of my reports and you look at the Chyron below from 2019, I'm talking about this back then. Just no one really took it so seriously. I took it seriously because it's the information I was getting in real time. But now it's starting to align for a lot of people. So you have Hamas and Islamic Jihad inside Gaza. And then you also have Hamas and Islamic Jihad offshoots in the West Bank, in places like Jenin, Nablus, Tulkarm, all of these cities that are very, very close to Israel, sometimes just a few hundred feet from Israeli towns or borders. But then you have Hezbollah, an organization that some estimates say have 150,000 rockets and missiles all aimed at Israel. Some of them precision guided because those components were smuggled through Syria after an Iranian plane landed in Damascus or Aleppo and then made their way into southern Lebanon. So you have that threat, which is their largest proxy in the region. So there's three. Then we've got a fourth threat, the Houthis in Yemen. And people say, well, it's Yemen. I was in Tel Aviv when a Houthi drone slammed into the center of the city. I heard the explosion, ran downstairs in the middle of the night and to the site at the aftermath, and a person was killed there and many people were injured. And it almost hit the U.S. embassy branch in Tel Aviv. It was literally one block away, that Houthi drone. Then you also have Iran-backed Iraqi and Syrian Shia militias. And then you have Iran itself. And so the tentacles, as has been described to me before, of the Iranian octopus, and this is not my words, these are the words of officials who describe what Iran is doing in the region, they reach very far. And it's part of the reason Israel has gone above and beyond to send a message to Iran. They hit their right next to their consulate in Syria. They killed a top Hezbollah commander who had met often with Iranian officials in Tehran. And Ismail Haniyeh, while they won't go on the record, the leader of Hamas, happened to die in an explosion at the inauguration ceremony while he was in a guest house of Masoud Pezeshkian, the man who replaced the Iranian president who was killed in a helicopter crash. And so Israel is fighting Iran on multiple fronts as we speak. And literally as we speak, it is unfolding. Those rocket alerts come in, and it is an ongoing thing that will one day have to stop, according to Israeli officials. And that's sort of the next question in all of this. Will there be a larger war between Israel and Hezbollah in Lebanon? And what will that look like?
So I've got to ask you, you know, this was shocking to me, and I'm interested if it was Israel's inability to control the narrative, the amount of anti-Semitism that has sort of come to the forefront, not only in the United States, but across the world. Did you expect that? Is this Israel not controlling the narrative of the war and in media? Because I found it excruciatingly shocking. I mean, I didn't know there was that much anti-Semitism in the world.
I think Israeli officials expected this to happen, and in private conversations have expressed frustration with the Israeli messaging about the war. And I think that's playing out on the streets of the United States. We see it with these campus protests. And I talked about this on Fox the other day, watching some of this video in real time that was coming in. And it actually wasn't a planned part of the report, but it was just something that I noticed. One of the protesters was carrying the flag of Saudi Arabia and didn't realize that it wasn't the Hamas flag. And you hear some of the comments that are being made about Israel and about the Jewish people in these conversations that are taking place on American college campuses. And the first thing that I think is that, again, this exists on a spectrum. Everyone from people who are totally uneducated to people that are blatantly anti-Semitic. And there's a combination of those people in these groups. And some of them are college students, and some of them are people that show up to campus because they feel it's a space for them to be able to say whatever they want around people that will support them. Israeli officials in meetings that I've had have been very frustrated with the global response to the conflict. And they're watching closely what's happening in the United States. They're watching for the outcome of the election. They're watching what's happening on college campuses because they are worried that threats against their people and their civilians abroad could be real, and they could turn into action. And it's part of the reason they've urged, especially Israelis have urged their citizens to take extra precaution when traveling abroad.
I want to ask one more question specific to the book, and then sort of move into to how you're, let's say, taking care of yourself, which is extremely difficult given the environment and just the schedule that you deal with on a daily basis. But it was General Mattis that once replied to post-traumatic stress. And he said, I actually believe in post-traumatic growth, that being exposed to war makes us more empathetic, more respectful human beings. And you did a quote recently on Instagram and Twitter, which I read probably about 10 times. Of course, I liked it. And I want to read that for the audience. And of course, we'll put it up in the article. You can have empathy for the Palestinian children who are killed amid war, and empathy for Israeli children who were killed on October 7th. And you can express concern for the Israeli hostages being held in Gaza and for the Palestinian civilians who are suffering. What have you learned about empathy during this conflict that maybe you didn't realize existed when you covered all the other conflicts, Afghanistan, Ukraine? I mean, how has this changed you as a human being? And what do you think we, who are so comfortable and safe within the United States, don't realize and need to take into consideration?
When I write about this in Black Saturday, the experience of covering war and how it changes you as an individual. I've been pretty open about my struggles with mental health that started around the Ukraine war. There were really difficult days in the early part of that war that I won't get into now, but that were challenging for me personally. And then going from a civilian life to covering the largest ground war in Europe since World War II and going to these villages that had been liberated by Ukrainian forces and seeing the aftermath of the war, I started to have nightmares about the situation. I immediately, as I was sort of struggling with what we had seen in real time and what had happened to our team and just everything that combined together, I immediately made a commitment to myself that I was going to handle this in a positive way. Like, I wasn't going to fall into the trap of how other war correspondents that came before me traditionally have. There is a culture that exists from the generation right before me of war correspondents, of drugs and alcohol, of finding a way to deal with all of the horrible things that we see in war by getting drunk and by just trying to sort of numb the pain. And I was determined to not let that happen. And I don't know necessarily where that stemmed from. Maybe it was watching so many David Goggins videos, No One's Coming to Save Me, or Jocko, or just, I consume a lot of motivational content that's meant to make men better and to make men healthier and to not be out partying, but to be working on themselves. And I think that I had that as a base. But so I determined, like, I stopped drinking at the beginning of last year. It's been almost 2 years since I drank, just because I was more productive on the weekends. I felt like a healthier version of myself. This war that started again, just as I felt that I was really getting to that level that Mattis talks about, right? Of growth from the experience, this war started. And let me just give you an understanding of where I was at the end of September last year and the beginning of October, right before this happened. We covered the earthquake in Morocco, which was really sad in the beginning of September, but I was doing really well, like mentally. I was doing ice baths, cold plunges. I was going on runs, going to the gym, eating clean, which I'm still doing now, got back into. But when the war happened here, again, it hits you immediately overnight. I'm a big believer, and it's better to be a warrior in a garden than a gardener in a war. And so I mentally and physically have trained for this to happen, hoping that it never does. And I went to bed on October 6th, not thinking I was going to wake up to a war that I'm still covering today, almost a year later. But I did. And so I went and I worked hard and I covered the story in real time. But we saw really, really horrific things. People died in front of us on the morning of the 7th. We went into the kibbutzim, these communities along the border, and they were filled with bodies of dead civilians and dead militants everywhere. It was like a horror movie, piles and piles of bodies. And I knew then, and this is very vulnerable, but it's just like, you're someone that I look up to a lot and I trust. And it's just, I knew then I had to make a decision that I am going to keep the fundamentals of journalism that I have learned to be the best objective, clear-headed foreign correspondent that there is today, to be the best in the world. And to do that, I couldn't let my emotions consume me, because it would have been really easy to see all of that and say, that's it. I just feel this way and I'm gonna report in this way. No, I am an old school objective journalist. I report in the shoes of Cronkite, of Murrow, of the people who did it right, who went to the war zones and gathered the information and brought it back to the audience. And I'm gonna keep doing that. And that means talking to Israelis. That means talking to Palestinians. And that means finding the lowest common denominator of people, the people who are struggling the most, who represent the average person in the society, talking to them and telling their stories from a human perspective that makes people care. And this is a long answer to your question, but in
Oh, yeah.
Black Saturday, I feel that I capture that in a way that I don't think a lot of journalists do. I think I captured the suffering of the Israeli people, the massacre that unfolded against the population on the morning of October 7th. And I also think I've captured the suffering of the Palestinian people. Israel's war in response to that massacre has left thousands of civilians dead. They have also killed thousands of Hamas militants and Islamic Jihad militants, gunmen who have engaged them inside Gaza. But the Israeli campaign against Gaza has not been, it's not been something positive. And I think anyone who celebrates what has happened should look in the mirror, because war is horrific. War is horrible. I wish that I didn't have to cover this, but if I do, I want to make sure that I cover it in a human first way, the true experience of humans on the ground. And so that means capturing the suffering of Israelis and capturing the suffering of Palestinians. And that means talking to the Palestinians who have been displaced internally in Gaza, talking to people who have lost family members, covering the stories, as I do in Black Saturday, of innocent people whose families were killed in Israeli airstrikes, oftentimes that didn't involve the killing of Hamas or Islamic Jihad militants. And it's part of my role as a journalist, as I tell these stories, to hold everyone accountable, to hold Hamas accountable for this massacre that took place against civilians, but also to hold Israelis accountable, to hold Israeli officials accountable for the airstrikes that they conduct inside Gaza. Because that is my role as a journalist, to be an objective observer, to hold those in power accountable on all sides of conflict. And my personal goal is to humanize the people involved so that the viewer, the listener, and the reader can understand why people do what they do.
You are in the thick of it now. And we talked about compartmentalization earlier in this this conversation. There still has to be an element of that while you're over there covering this. But what are you doing differently now versus Afghanistan or Ukraine and covering those conflicts to sort of dampen or stay ahead of the mental and spiritual trauma that you are encountering so that you just don't, let's say, you're not a total and complete mess at the end of this? Was writing this book part of that process? Are you speaking to it there?
Writing Black Saturday was really cathartic for me. It was an opportunity to get my story out on paper and also do what motivates me, which is get the stories of other people out on paper. The majority of the book is not about me. It's about the people who were most affected by this conflict. Because, look, I'm a TV journalist. I'm on TV. People know who I am. They follow me on social media. But I don't want this story to be about me. I'm a part of this story because I covered it, and I hope that my role in this story is someone who is trusted to go there and get the facts. And I do think that I can play a role in Black Saturday in the book that I wrote about this, but also in my role as a journalist to be able to go to the places that other people won't go and tell the stories that other people won't tell. But in terms of getting ahead of that, I knew that this was going to be tough to process, to think through. And so having good habits to fall back on, I think it's critical. And this is what I had in place, right? So I immediately, when I had the chance and we had a more regular schedule and we could get food, because in the early days of the conflict, we weren't eating on a regular basis. We weren't sleeping on a regular basis. But now I try to eat really clean. I go to the gym almost on a daily basis and I go for runs. And for me, there's just something about running. I don't actually like to run. I don't think that I am a skillful runner from a technique perspective. And I don't know that I have the discipline when I run that I have in other parts of my life to pace myself. But sometimes if I'm feeling overwhelmed or I'm thinking about October 7th or what's happening to the people of Gaza, or I'm just consumed by my thoughts, if I get really down, rather than going out and having a couple beers, especially on a weekend, because it's tempting because my friends are going out in Tel Aviv, which is a city that's known for nightlife, I look in the mirror, I say, let's go. And my initial thought is, I don't want to go run 10K. And when I have that thought, and again, I think this just goes back to watching Alex Hormozi or David Goggins or Jocko, like when I have that thought, I'm like, oh, good, good, good. You're feeling weak. Now you're running 15K. Like, and that internal dialogue, I think, has really, really helped me, because it is a mentality thing. And it's like, I am not going to feel sorry for myself. I'm going to stay focused on the mission. And I think in terms of getting ahead of it, like if you just look at the background of my phone right now says your goals, and in the middle, it's discipline and accomplishments. And I think that can be applied to anything in life. And that's what I do.
You know, discipline is just a framework. That's all it is. And it sounds like you've established that. Fortunately for you, you had established that prior to October 7th. And that's probably the saving grace. I've got to ask two fun questions. One very selfish of me, but where does a relationship fall in on this? Is there a partner somewhere or a relationship, or is it just you are so thick into your career right now that there's just no place for that?
Right now, there's not. You know, I've had girlfriends since I've had this job. I've dated Israelis, I've dated Palestinians. I write about that in Black Saturday as well. But right now, I'm in like a chapter of my life that feels quite isolating. But also a chapter where I feel like I'm growing in a very rapid way, because like, I know what I want to do. Like I know what the end goal in all of this is. And it's not to be someone who has a talk show and says, look at me. Like I want to build out a media brand that allows humans around the world to connect. And if that brand is me, great. If it's not, great, but I'm so thankful to work at Fox because they give me the opportunity to do just that. Like, they give me the opportunity to travel the world and tell the stories of humans. And so right now it's not the best time for a relationship. Eventually down the road, it would be nice to have a girlfriend, have a partner, because this can get very lonely, this job. But right now I'm just like, I feel like I'm in the thick of what I want to do.
That is one of the most difficult and mature decisions to make. I almost realized, because my first marriage ended in divorce, that it was almost selfish to enter into a relationship knowing that we were going to be deploying to war every single year for 10 years. So no, that is a mature decision, especially at your tenure. But you've got your vision of where you want to go, and there will be a time for those relationships. And the selfish question is, when's the last time you skydived? Because I'm sure your USPA certification is completely debunked at this
This is
point.
it's totally debunked. I'm gonna have to retake the not even the refresher course, probably the initial course. But it's been a while.
Yeah. Well, guys, you got to check this out. October 1st. Black Saturday is an opportunity to get an objective look at the Israel-Hamas conflict rather than watching one media outlet or the other. And we are sort of stunted by who we watch and which media outlet we follow. So, Trey, I commend you, man. I'm still shocked that you found the time to produce a 300-page, novel on the current conflict. And my hat's off to you, man. Accolades on doing that, given the schedule that you keep.
Well, Mike, thank you. And thank you for your interest in my work from the beginning of this. I've always appreciated our conversations because it's refreshing to talk to someone who understands.
And most importantly, best wishes and stay safe to both you and your crew out there, and come home.
Thank you, Mike.
All right, guys. Thanks. That's been another episode of the Everyday Warrior Podcast. We look forward to seeing you again.